What's up, guys? Welcome to this very special episode of the Sat Signal on the Unemployable Channel. Today, I am joined by Michael Jordan, not the basketballer, but a white guy from the US. It's a great interview. I met Michael at Bitcoin Prague, and he was one of the keynotes there, and he gave this exceptional speech. And right afterwards, I hunted him down. I said, dude, can I get you on my pod? I want to hear your story. We had a really wide-ranging discussion. We talked about his journey into Bitcoin, why he got into it, and the massive impact it's had on his life as a father, as a leader, as somebody who's taking full responsibility for his money, his kids' education, his health, how Bitcoin was the catalyst for all of those changes that are deep into his life. We talk about the power of self-sovereignty. We talk about Bitcoin treasuries, Bitcoin lending, and he and I have slightly different views on this. So it's an interesting chat. I think you guys are really, really going to enjoy this one. If you do, make sure you comment, like, of course, share this episode with people that you want to get to learn more about Bitcoin. With that said, let's get into it. So, Michael, welcome to the show, mate. Lovely to have you here. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. I'm great. Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure meeting you in Prague, and I'm glad we get to chat here via video now.
Yeah, I'm really excited for our audience to meet you. I obviously know, Tony, who you work with at the Bitcoin Way, and I watched you speak in Prague, and I hunted you down afterwards and said, dude, that was such an epic talk. And I genuinely mean that. So I'm hoping we can unpack some of what you sort of chatted about in Prague. But maybe just give us a bit of a snapshot, Michael, of, how you came to Bitcoin. Like, how did you discover this technology? Where were you in your life? And what initially drew you to it?
Yeah, so that, I think that's a good place to start. So I've only been in Bitcoin a few years. I'm 3 years into my journey about. So at the end of every year, I set a goal, like a learning goal for the next year, right? And I said, I want to learn about this particular topic. And in late 2021, I decided I needed to dive into crypto. And so that was, yeah, I started getting books and podcast recommendations and that sort of thing. I was fortunate. I met up with a friend of a friend, the only person in my sphere who knew anything about crypto or Bitcoin or whatever. And I was fortunate I met him because he introduced me to this concept of like the Bitcoin horseshoe, right? You start in Bitcoin because it's the big one. And then you kind of go through this crypto sort of, journey. And then you end up back in Bitcoin if you stick around long enough and take the time to deep dive. And he introduced me to Preston Pish's podcast, Bitcoin Fundamentals. I remember him mentioning Lynn Alden. And so as I started 2022, which was like the year of this learning journey that I was on, I was listening to audiobooks about blockchain. I had a couple of crypto podcast recommendations. And then I slowly began listening to Preston's podcast in particular. So major shout out to Preston for probably being the primary driver of my orange pilling experience. And if you remember 2022, if you're around, everything crashed, right? And what I noticed very quickly was the toxic Bitcoin maxis have been right about everything. They called Celsius, shout out to Corey Clipston at Swan. He was one of the first people I came across who was just consistently calling out all of the things that were going to break, and they did. And so by mid late 2022, I was myself a toxic Bitcoin maxi. And the rest is history, right? I, sort of went through varying degrees of, custody, collaborative custody before finding the Bitcoin Way. And I heard Tony on a podcast as well. I think it was Saifedean's podcast, and became very evident. If I want to be a sovereign individual, I need to do this the right way. I need to hold the keys. I need to quit sharing KYC information with people, quit sharing keys with people, and trusting anyone else to do this for me. And so went through that path, and along the way, they were looking to hire. I turned out to be a fit for what they were looking for. My job has changed immensely. Now I'm hosting our podcast, working with our partners, doing all sorts of things. And as you indicated of late, speaking on the main stage at Prague, which was quite an experience to imagine. 3 years before, I barely knew anything about Bitcoin, and it was just surreal.
Yeah, that's extraordinary to me when you said that you have only been in Bitcoin since 2022, because the way you articulated yourself, maybe it's hanging out with Tony all the time or something, that's your ability to articulate what Bitcoin is and the dangers that you see in a lot of what's going on now, which I'd like to sort of jump into. There's so much hype around Bitcoin treasuries and all of that. And I think you sit in a really unique spot as well at the Bitcoin Way, in that you sort of sit in the epicenter of people's thoughts. Like, some of them are coming to you to, buy Bitcoin because they want to protect it, and ultimately it's just an investment. And then you've got others that are coming to you to talk about sovereignty and escaping the countries. Other people are, probably in the community are talking about treasury. So I want to dive into that. But maybe we could just have a little bit of a personal talk about you, as in, what were you doing at the time you discovered Bitcoin? Like, what background do you come from? Do you have kids and a family? Like, just a little bit of background about where you are in your life would be helpful.
So I've been married about 12 years. I have three beautiful kids, a beautiful wife, and I've always just kind of been a curious person, I guess. I mean, I suppose the fact that I, have these learning goals that I embark upon each year, and maybe gives you a sense as to sort of the odd sort of person that I am. But I was, let's see, in 2022. I'd worked with my dad's company. My background's sort of semi-technical, cybersecurity. That's what my graduate degree is in. I worked in sales with my dad's company. He sold it 6, 7 years ago now, just before COVID. So good timing for him. My brother and I started a company shortly thereafter. We sold our company, sort of a cybersecurity compliance company, real small firm. And we sold that, and I think it was, I guess, in between selling that and trying to figure out what comes next that I sort of began discovering Bitcoin. And so it was, I guess, like the time I had to invest in listening to the podcast, reading the books, doing all of the things that we talk about, it was serendipitous in some way. But it was, I'm trying to think. So I talked about my son in my speech in Prague, and he's 4 years old. And so it was actually, I've only been in Bitcoin 3 years. So he had been born when I started talking about, my concern about where things are headed and what, these forever wars might mean for, I was fortunate, I guess, to skip over some of that. But when my son's a teenager, what does the world look like for him in particular? I've got two beautiful girls as well. But I'm less concerned about them being, sent off to die in some foreign war that no one cares about. So that's sort of my family life, and it maybe gives you a little bit of frame of reference for why I approach this in such a way. I would also add that being at the Bitcoin Way has reoriented me away from Bitcoin as what I kind of thought it was when I was early. It's like this number go up technology. Should I be investing into how can I be a part of this revolution and be a part of the change that I want to see in the world? And I guess my, without spilling too much before we get into the speech, my sort of thesis is it really starts at the individual level, the family unit. What are the changes you can make to opt out of fiat, to opt out of the fiat nonsense, not just the money, but these systems in which we find ourselves. And having a family, I think, is the ultimate catalyst for, being willing to explore this world as maybe something that you didn't think it was, and maybe there's a better way of doing things.
So tell me about that. So when you first discovered Bitcoin, I imagine you probably read the Bitcoin Standard or some of these books. Was there a book that really, got you orange pilled, or really, for new listeners, orange pilled means convinced, like in the Matrix, where Morpheus holds the red pill and the blue pill and says, which one do you want to? Do you want to go down this rabbit hole and change your life, or do you want to just have this one and forget this conversation ever happened? But the orange pill is the one where you take that and you start to see a whole different world, and we go down the rabbit hole of money, and it's sort of, we realize how pervasive money is in our lives, and how every moment from the moment we wake up to go to bed, money touches almost everything we do. What was it? Like, what was the book or books that sort of did it for you? And what were the concepts that most shifted you and drew you to this in a really meaningful way now?
I think the Bitcoin standard was an important one for me. It was really the first time I'd explored the history of money in any meaningful way, and it began to add up why we would want to migrate toward a commodity-based money. Obviously, I think the more you learn about the technology of Bitcoin, and it's not something I'm not a developer, I'm not, so technically fluent that I could go into all the nuts and bolts, but you realize we need a digital commodity money in a digital global age. And so I think sort of piecing together a lot of that, as I mentioned, Preston's podcast was incredibly helpful and informative. And like certain episodes were more valuable than others, kind of hit or miss. And like there are certain topics I still don't dive into as deeply as I probably could. But for me, the real important thing is that we're promoting, self-sovereignty, self-custody, running a node, all of the things that we need to maintain the health of the Bitcoin network and to give people the tools and the ability to completely opt out of the system and to avoid the counterparty risk that we sort of inherently usually take on. I have learned a lot though from gosh, I mean, so many people. I mean, one of my favorite Bitcoiners is Daniel Prince. Learned a lot from his podcast. On the macro level, James Lavish, Lynn Alden. A lot of the people that you probably think about when you think about like speaking at a Bitcoin conference or joining as a podcast guest. And it was sort of this accumulation of knowledge from a technical perspective, a macroeconomic perspective, and then this, I don't know how to quite articulate it, but like this migration of thought, like this paradigm shift for me from Bitcoin is like this investment, it's going to outperform all these other things because of these characteristics too. Bitcoin has the potential to change the world if it's used properly. And, as someone with a family, like I have enough Bitcoin in self-custody. I think I'm 3 years in, so my stack isn't that big, but like I think it's a meaningful amount that like I can provide for my family into the future. What's way more important to me now is I think about, well, what does that future look like? Because if it's just a store of value and it's just this digital Fort Knox and the money printer continues and Bitcoiners keep getting wealthier and wealthier because the old system continues as is, does that really change anything in a meaningful way? Do we win in the bright orange future that we want? So I know I sort of went off on a tangent, but those are sorts of the it's been a journey, not just of like resources that I've listened to and read and accumulated, but also like this whole change of thought as I've gone on this journey. And I would add, one of the biggest sources of learning for me has been working with the Bitcoin Way, because the guys on the team are so uncompromising about the importance of self-sovereignty. And it's like every, few months, like this new, like it clicks a little bit further for me, like why this is so important. And that's why I talk about like the Bitcoin treasury companies a lot, and the Bitcoin lending products and all of these other things that many people find very exciting. I tend to have a more contrarian take on, because for me, it's not about how much fiat can I accumulate. It's how much Bitcoin can I accumulate with as little counterparty risk as possible. So I answered
Yeah.
probably a few questions there, but
I want to dive into the treasury companies and the Bitcoin lending products in a minute for sure, because they're such a buzz section at the moment. And I'd love to bounce ideas off you and, a little bit with that. But when you say something like self-sovereignty, like a lot of people have no concept what you're talking about when you describe self-sovereignty. And I know why it's important to me, and you know why it's important to you. But for somebody who's only lived in a fiat world, meaning you've got a job, you get paid in Australian dollars, you get paid in American dollars, and it goes in your bank and you pay your bills and you got a little bit left over that you want to invest, right? That's somebody living in a fiat world. They don't think about much because there's so much on the treadmill. What does self-sovereignty mean when you explain that to somebody? What does it mean in your words?
I think self-sovereignty is the ownership of your time, your value. It's a sort of freedom that we take for granted as even a possibility in a fiat world, where the entire system in which we find ourselves is reliant upon counterparties. The grocery store to get your food, and somewhere further up the supply chain, the farmer to grow the food, and the banks to quote unquote, keep your money, because that's not really what they're doing. But like, there's so much counterparty risk, and it makes it all very fragile, right? If you aren't able to, in some way, supply your own food, secure your own wealth, take care of your body and ensure that you're healthy, all of these things, it's like we rely on pharmaceutical companies for that. We rely on, grocery stores, we rely on banks, rely on, and like the list goes on and on. Self-sovereignty is the optionality, I think, to leverage and utilize those tools when necessary or when helpful, but maybe not to rely on them in some fundamental way in our normal course of life.
So
There are.
do you extend it beyond money in your life? Like, are you growing your own food and stuff as well? Or are you just really talking about self-sovereignty of money of removing the counterparties in that area of your life?
So just in the last year, we've started growing some of our own food. I'm investigating chickens. I live on some land. We've got plenty of firearms here, so hunting is on the table. Haven't done it since we've moved to this house, but like having those sorts of options, or at least the skill set, the ability to utilize those options if it were necessary. In the meantime, like we use grocery stores. Like, it's a convenient way to get the majority of the food that we can't currently provide ourselves, though we're inching in that direction. But having the ability for me to grow some of my own food, as I mentioned, like chickens, eggs are a huge part of my diet. So why not save the money and just learn to do it myself? I think that's an easy win that we could have. And that was sort of what I alluded to in the speech, was it's not simply. Like having Bitcoin in self-custody is a massive win, and you can't under like being able to manage your wealth sovereignly is fundamental, because to your point, money touches everything. But there's so much other fiat nonsense out there that I think people don't even realize. Like one thing I've done in my life is I joined, if you've heard of Crowd Health. So
No.
I canceled our fiat health insurance for my family, and we're using Crowd Health now. It's sort of a hard concept to explain, but effectively you still pay like sort of a lower premium, and then if someone has in the community of 10,000 people has a medical event, you might be asked to pitch in to help fund that. And then when you have something come up, then and so it's like a little bit of a not catastrophic, but they're not going to cover you unless your bill for an event hits $500, and then after that the community will pitch in. And so I've got three little kids, it's more expensive with a kid who's getting an ear infection every few months, or whatever the case may be, but it's a financial decision I've made, because I want to vote out of I want nothing to do with the health insurance companies. I want to self-pay and be in charge of what we do as a family when it comes to our health care. We've moved our kids from a doctor that runs the full vax schedule, all the nonsense, to someone who doesn't require that. We got to pay out of pocket. It costs me more money, right? But for the sake of my kids' health, it's worth it. And I'm fortunate to be able to afford to do that. We're homeschooling our kids. I don't want to fund the fiat education system any more than I have to. They make me pay taxes. Yes, okay. Like I get that, but I don't need my kids to be indoctrinated in a blue light lit room for 7 hours a day to learn useless stuff at best and dangerous stuff at worst, right? And so it's just like these little decisions that we can make. And I know some of these seem like big decisions. It's been a journey, and that's why I'm not doing everything all at once. But it's, what are these decisions that I can make as an individual for my family with my wife that are going to ultimately better our life and give us flexibility, optionality to live the lives we want, to be the people we want, to raise the children we want, and that.
How much of these types of decisions and thinking came about after you started to learn about Bitcoin? Because so many people, when they start learning about how broken the money is and all the inequities that are funded through this evil fiat system, where governments can print money to start and fight wars, where there's a massive unfair advantage to the people next to the money printer and so on. As Tony says, they print money so they can live for free while we all pay. How much of these kinds of other areas, because it's interesting, it's the first time I've thought about it in talking to you, that growing your own food is sort of like taking sovereignty over that area of your life, self-custody of your food supply, as opposed to relying on the counterparty of the supermarkets and all of the inherent corruption and poison and bad things that goes on in that world, as you can go out in the backyard and grow your own organic goods. It's kind of the same, right? It's taking custody of your food supply, now taking custody of your money. But how much of it came post Bitcoin, or were you already on those paths?
I would say about 100% of it came post Bitcoin.
Is that right?
Yeah, and it would be hard to explain myself today to
Wow.
me 5 years ago. You commented on my American flag when we first hopped on, and I was just the most patriotic American, red-blooded Republican you could possibly imagine. And boy, that's changed, right? My sort of philosophical outlook on what would be ideal has changed. Even my practical, what in light of our current situation, what's the best option? How I view most of history. I mean, my poor wife, we'll be talking at night, and she'll be like, "What happened to you?"
Yes.
not this is not the man that I remember marrying. But she seems to still love me, so it works. But I think the interesting thing, though, and this is an aside for especially men out there, because I see this question all the time, like, how do you orange pill your wife kind of thing? Here's the thing. The answer for me is a little, maybe it's easier for me. My wife didn't have a choice. Like, she trusts me fully, and I began to learn and understand, and my conviction grew. And so we were going to accumulate as much Bitcoin as we could while continuing to live the life that we wanted to live. So we haven't sold all of our chairs. I know, I understand the memes, and more power to you if that's your thing. I've got kids that I want to raise in a home where they have a couch. But I guess what's been interesting for me is actually her journey that she's been on. Like, she hasn't read the Bitcoin books and all of that, but she is increasingly looking for new health remedies for the kids. Very eager about, like, with homeschooling, for example. At first, it was like okay, I agree. I think we should try this. Let's figure it out. Like, now the answer is like, we will figure it out. Like, this isn't like a temporary thing. Whatever it takes, like, we are not putting our kids into an indoctrination camp for 7 hours a day. And so, because she trusted me, and I guess part of that is hopefully, previous decisions I've made that have earned her trust. None of these were like things that were called into question. And so my Bitcoin journey has been the catalyst for, all these things I've mentioned. The fact that, like, I haven't had dessert in like literally 2.5 years. I eat an animal-based diet, no, I haven't had vegetables in at least 2 years. Like, I mean, a lot of the things that, you kind of hear stereotypical of Bitcoiners, like, I've gone on those paths and learned enough that almost every aspect of my life has been touched in some way, some significant way, by Bitcoin. And it's been fun for me getting to see my wife, sort of dip her toes in and slowly, ramp up, her interest in some of these other things. And I can only imagine where we'll be 5 years from now.
I think this is a really interesting point. I think when we start our Bitcoin journey and we're talking about money, what we're really talking about is the thing that we exchange our time for. And then if we pull on that thread a little bit, we realize that the only other thing in this world that is non-renewable, apart from Bitcoin, is the time that we're given on this planet, and that is a spiritual gift. And so when we go, okay, so how are we being rewarded for our time, and what technology has been given to us to store it? So if we do work and we want to and we get compensated, how do we store what we don't need right now to exchange with other people for food or rent or whatever, that leftover bit of time that is represented by the leftover money? When we start to realize that we live in a world which we call the fiat system, where between the banks printing more money and inflation, we've got the value of our storage technology is reducing the value of our time by over 10% a year, right? When you put those two things together, and you go, hang on a minute, does that mean that we have allowed the system to ourselves be in a system where they discount the value of our life every year by 10% or more? And the answer is yes. And when that hits you, you realize the evil that represents. That is one human being taking, or a very small group of human beings taking literally people's lives away from them and creating all sorts of societal problems, stress, because people having to work harder to earn the same. What they worked for yesterday is worth less in the future. And we're incentivized to spend money, not save money, because it becomes worth less the longer we hold it. And so we're consistently seeing, we're seeing young people not have families, we're seeing divorces, and we're seeing people do things with their body and their time in the DAO of Bitcoin that said, we turn our ho houses into hotels, our cars into taxis, and our bodies into porn. You realize the evil at the very base level. And this is why, listeners, what you're hearing Michael say right now, when somebody starts on that Bitcoin journey and gets that very fundamental thing, you start to then ask questions about health, family, education. What other matrices are we living in that are not serving us? The food that we put in our body, why do we do that? What drugs are we taking? Why? Where, what's the incentive? Who's on the other side of that matrix? It's very interesting.
Yeah, no, you nailed it. And for people who've been around Bitcoin for a little while, I tend to just be, I don't know, I'm a little crazy. Like it's been 3 years and I feel like I'm still going down rabbit holes, don't get me wrong, but like I've gone hard into this thing, right? And I mean, like I said, my diet's changed, my kids are homeschooled, we're growing our own food, we don't have health insurance anymore. Like, oh, I mean, it's like, one thing after the next. It's been I don't think everyone's going to have that journey at that velocity necessarily. My encouragement, though, is always if you think that your journey has stopped, you're probably not digging deep enough into what are the ways that I'm compromising, what are the ways that I'm taking on counterparty risk, what am I funding and feeding that I don't want to, whether it's the insurance companies, the education system, the big food companies. I mean, there's so many tentacles that need to be cut that most people, like for me, it's like I said, it's been a journey. Health insurance didn't cross my mind, and I started to learn a little bit more about crowd health, and I had a friend say, "Oh, dude, you got to check this out," and I kind of drug my feet on it a little bit, and then I don't know what it was. I know what it was. Last year, at some point, my wife broke her ankle, and we were looking for somewhere to take her. And like, oh, this is out of network. This is, oh, like it was just like one thing after the next. They made it impossible. And I was like, if we could just pay, fund ourselves, but have a backstop, like that's all we need. Like we don't need to run through the insurance, hoops and have to figure this out every time someone gets hurt or every time someone's, has a cough. And so it's like, I guess my encouragement would just be patient with yourself, but don't stop. Continue to find these new rabbit holes to go down, and your life will improve. I mean, one of the things I said in my speech was, my peace of mind has grown because I have all these beliefs, and now I'm actually doing the things in my world, in my life, with my family that align with those beliefs. And I think when there's that like cognitive dissonance, it's like frustrating. You feel like you got one foot in both systems. And to some degree, I understand you got to pay the bills and their fiat bills and everything. I mean, don't get me wrong, I'm not trying to be impractical. But generally speaking, those are sort of the exceptions. Those are like one-off things. What's the trajectory of your life? And the more it's a Bitcoin-oriented life, I just feel like the better it's gotten for me.
So talk to us about, your in your description, self-custody, because again, a lot of our listeners are new to Bitcoin and they know that, they can go to their exchange, whether it's CoinSpot or Coinbase or, any of these exchanges, and they think of it like buying a stock. They fund their account, which is getting harder and harder and harder in Australia at the moment. It's getting really tough to get money onto crypto exchanges. We're just like, okay, we go backwards in Australia. But they get their money onto the exchange, they go and buy the Bitcoin, and then they see in their exchange account, you now own one Bitcoin worth 160,000 Australian dollars or $100,000. Is that self-custody in Bitcoin? And if it's not, why is it not? What is a counterparty, and what are counterparty risks, and why should they not do that?
Yeah, so a few questions there. So no, that's not self-custody.
Right.
That's the first important one. A
Yeah.
counterparty is, I mean, I'll try to sort of loosely define this as it's any additional person, third party, any institution that you have to trust in order to access, use, leverage in any way your Bitcoin. Like that's maybe the best way of thinking of it. And so if Coinbase, let's say you buy at Coinbase, they can tell you, sorry, we're down for maintenance. They can tell you, sorry, your account's been frozen. They can tell you, sorry, you have a 30-day withdrawal holding period. So right
So
away,
sorry, the government has contacted us and they say that you made a racist remark and your account has been suspended. Like what's happening in the UK? Like it's
yeah,
happening.
you've ordered too much beef this month. We're removing access to
Whatever.
Bitcoin, right? Like, I mean, there's so many ways that Coinbase or government co-op, co-option could play a role in that. And I think that if you understand, like, there's this sort of cursory understanding of Bitcoin that you might feel like, okay, well, that's good enough. I'm here for the investment. It's like a bank account. So my brokerage account or whatever. And as long as I see that 100,000 turn into 120,000 turn into, I'm good. I'm not worried. I have a bank. Like, why would I be worried about Coinbase? And if you are here for number go up, you might be lucky enough that maybe your account isn't the one that's frozen, and maybe Coinbase doesn't go down, but you're taking on a lot of counterparty risk that most people just don't even think about. Like, everyone thought that the banks had their money in 1929 too, and it turned out they didn't, right? So like, what if yours is the bank that collapses? And Tony talks about this a lot. He warns everyone that the 2019 collapse that he experienced in Lebanon, where he lost everything, is coming to every major city. And I'm not even going to speculate on that. I think for people to write it off as a zero risk is foolish. There, the money printers are turned back on. Hyperinflations are the norm in many parts of the world, and there's nothing to say that eventually what he experienced doesn't reach other parts of the world, wherever you might be, even the
And the
US.
world and the world is super connected now. I remember in 2008, all of a sudden it seemed like out of nowhere, these things called mortgage-backed securities were gonna not just at first you're like, oh, that's happening in America, don't worry about it. But within like days, the entire financial system was on the precipice of complete collapse because of the way that how interconnected the world is.
Yeah. I'm not a macro guy, but like, look at Japan, right? Like, Japan,
Right.
it's like what, the third or fourth largest economy in the world. Like, it's and to imagine that something devastating happens in Japan and it doesn't impact everyone else is to me foolish. And so the more you begin to understand Bitcoin, the promise that it holds, the value of it being a bearer asset, the more obvious it becomes you need to take it off of the exchange. And then the question, I don't know how much you want to dive into this, the question becomes, well, okay, where do I move it to? What do I do with it? How do I secure it? And my take, and this is someone who went from a coin, I had my coins on Coinbase, I think just like almost everyone does, or some version of Coinbase, depending on where they are in the world. I went to a collaborative custody arrangement for a while. And what I realized was, you sort of have, okay, step in the right direction. I'll give you that. But I had to KYC myself. I was relying on a proprietary app on my phone in order to move my Bitcoin. So if they're down for maintenance, my Bitcoin's down, like I can't do anything with it, right? That it's not permissionless any longer, right? It's not 24/7, 365 availability. It's not censorship resistant. I was there's some customer support person on the back end who knows exactly how much Bitcoin I have and when I send it and when I receive it. And in order to support me as a customer, they have to know that, right? Because I might have questions for them. And then on top of that, I guess more nuanced stuff, they started accepting or started supporting a shitcoin. And I was like, ah, philosophically, this just doesn't seem right. But then I also didn't know much about hardware wallets at the time. I was using a really bad hardware wallet. I had to plug it into my computer. It's a totally unnecessary risk in this day and age. But the fact that they even supported that hardware wallet, now as I think about it, all sorts of alarm bells are going off. Like, if your goal is to make sure that your customers do not lose their Bitcoin, okay, you've made these other compromises I just described. At least make sure that one of the wallets that they're signing with is a really good one. And you know, they just kind of take all of them and say, okay, well, you know, we'll support all of them, so that way you can pick your own. To me, that's is a someone who understands this and works for a company now who helps people take self-custody. It's a disservice to people. Like, there are certain decisions that I think you need to, as the professional, you need to take into your own hands and say, we're just not going to support those things because we think those are inferior. We think there are risks that are not worth taking. And here's your options. It's fewer, but they're really, really good. And most people want someone to trust. You want to be trusting people who are uncompromising and only have a few options because they know that all the rest of them are, you know, potentially terrible or risks not worth taking. And so that's how I ended up getting to like full self-custody. I found the Bitcoin way. And just for listeners, I mean, what we do is we don't ask you for KYC information. We don't ever need to know who you are. You can use a fake name, fake email. I mean, use an email you have access to. You don't have to share yourself on video, but we train our clients to go through this process. How do you secure the information that you need in order to log into your hardware wallet? How do you set up your hardware wallet? How do you generate a seed phrase, do it properly? How do you secure that seed phrase completely offline? How do you run a node, connect this all together? Do you have the skills then to receive transactions, to send transactions? And when you get done working with us in our self-custody service, we don't have to know who you are. We have no idea how much Bitcoin you have, and you have the skills to secure and use your Bitcoin properly. That to me is self-custody. Everything else is some nuanced, you know, take on, well, what about collaborative custody? Is that self-custody? Not in my view. Self-custody is you hold the keys. You're the one who knows how much Bitcoin you have. Optimally, you're running a node. You're adding to your privacy in that way. So that's, you know, sort of a long-winded answer, but it's a far cry from leaving your coins on a Coinbase or any sort of exchange.
So for the listeners, you know, I have been a Bitcoiner since 2017. I've been on this journey, and prior to meeting Tony and the Bitcoin Way, I was using a service that cost me about $2,000 a year, and it's a shared, how did you describe it? Shared custodial, where you have over five.
Collaborative custody, probably.
Collaborative, yeah, collaborative. So it's a multi-sig wallet, so it needs multiple signatures to move money, and it's collaborative custody where I've got another counterparty that's involved in my custody, which on the surface feels like I've got security. But now that I've been working with you guys, I'm starting to understand that it's not true self-custody. And Tony explained to me, you know, like, this is a skill, learning to custody your piece of that blockchain yourself is a skill that once you have, that you can access that value, move that value in part or in full, you know, without having to involve or share information with third parties, is a very liberating experience that you go through. And I'm just going through the process now, and I paid full freight as a client. I didn't get a discount. I didn't ask for one. And it's a skill that once your family has it, you know that you can access that money without any bank, any app, any of those things. And it's incredibly empowering once you do it.
It really is. I felt the same way. And it was, you know, as I said, after listening to Tony on a podcast, and then as I sort of signed up for the service, not really knowing like what exactly I was getting myself into, how it was going to work. But once you go through that process and you send your first transactions, you receive your first transactions, you like do these things that, you know, now to me seem rather trivial, you realize just how incredibly powerful it is. One of
It's
the,
what I'm going through it right now, that exact phase. The first time I ever spent Bitcoin was with you guys. And I've only bought and acquired it and put it into my wallet. And I said, Tony, I'm embarrassed to say I need help to actually figure out how to actually pay you this invoice because I only know how to buy it and move it off an exchange and into my wallet. So learning it. So it is incredibly powerful to do. And it's a journey, and you know, it's you, I feel I came to your stand in Prague and was asking questions, and it's we all feel like dummies, and I've got a bit of Bitcoin and I've been here for 7 years, and I still don't really fully understand self-custody like you guys do. It's very interesting.
Yeah, it's and like I said, I'm earlier on this journey than you are, but it's we sort of reach these points in our journey separately where you kind of figure out the next thing and that. And I was fortunate to sort of stumble across the Bitcoin way. Just one more word of warning for anyone who's, because there are so many people using collaborative custody, and I think part of the appeal is the convenience of it, right? Like, oh, well, I just, I buy it, I send to this wallet, and probably most people aren't spending their Bitcoin, which is something else we can talk about if you want to. If one of the risks that a lot of people don't realize is that you don't simply need two keys to in order to send a transaction in a multi-sig. There are actually other like config files and like other things that you need in order to recover your funds, like if you were to lose one of your keys. And so you're not, and if you look at the instructions on from some of these providers, first of all, you got to have that information. So not just the keys, but you got to have that information, those files. But it's also like an incredibly burdensome technical undertaking to then go recover that Bitcoin. Like if the government were to intervene and say don't let people send their Bitcoin, well, hypothetically you should still be, have access to your Bitcoin. But it's not just a walk in the park, and you might not even have all the information that you need to recover your Bitcoin anyway. And so the marketing for everything is slick. There are trade-offs for any solution. There are trade-offs for self-custody too. But there are a lot of ways with self-custody. You can add a lot of redundancy. You can, share part of your seed phrase with one trusted person and part of your seed phrase with another trusted person who live, in geographically dispersed areas. Keep one yourself. Our friends at Microseed, 21e15, they have a product called Microseed. And it's like you can stamp your entire 24-word seed phrase into a single washer. So like you don't need no more buying like a plate to do that. And so you could bolt it into the ceiling of your house somewhere where no one would ever know that that has your seed phrase on it. Like there are a lot of ways to be discreet, to add redundancy, to take self-custody without it being a single point of failure, which is all of the fear-mongering that the non-self-custody solutions sort of evoke. So it's yeah, it's again, it's a journey, so many
Yeah.
ways, but of going about this, but I it's a liberating feeling to know that you alone are using open source tools. You're doing it right. No one can stop you. That's what makes Bitcoin unstoppable.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a very, very powerful feeling that is, I do worry about the way the world is going, and I especially as we move into a world of AI and there's talk of universal base income, if that is does happen, then I can't see a world where we're not going to have massive unemployment. And if we are going to have massive unemployment and people are going to be giving credits from the government, those credits economic power, our government issued digital tokens of some kind. That's terrifying to me because I'm such a free speech absolutist and believe that we should be able to say, people should be able to say whatever they want, even if it's offensive. I still want them to be able to say it, even if I don't agree with it. All these sort of things sort of conflate to a very scary future. I just, if you take money off the table as something that you can be leveraged over, you're free. But so many people are leveraged and doing things they don't want to do just simply because of money. Could you just maybe just for beginners in a really simple way, or however you want to explain it, what is a Bitcoin node? I've just bought one and I haven't installed it yet, but I'm going to meet Tony in Athens probably, and he's offered to help me get it explained to me. But what is a Bitcoin node? Why is it important? And what role do they play in Bitcoin?
Yeah, so I'm probably the worst person on the team you could ask this question to, but I'll do my best here because I think the deeper you understand the technology, which I'm probably the worst at that on the team because we got a whole crew of people who just set these up all day long. So a Bitcoin node is a it's a small computer that plugs into your router. It doesn't look like a computer. It looks like a little box, like a little server. And what it's doing is it's running the Bitcoin software. So Bitcoin Core, Knots, there are a few implementations of the software that basically the node runs. And so what it's doing is it helps you. So like I'll give you an example. So if you're sending, you use your computer to initiate sending a Bitcoin transaction, right? And you sign it with your hardware wallet, and then you go in and you show the signature to that wallet on your computer, and you hit send. That transaction, the details of that transaction are going to go through a node out to the Bitcoin network. They're going to be broadcast to the network. And so the question is, whose node is it running through? So if you're moving coins from Coinbase to, your own, hardware wallet or to your own setup or another exchange, doesn't really matter. You're using Coinbase's node to broadcast that transaction to the network. When you run your own node, you've got this little device plugged in into your router. It's at home or in your office, wherever you're doing this, and it's just running at all times. And so anytime, if you connect it properly, which is what we help people do, anytime you send a transaction, you're running your transactions through your node. So first of all, it gives you some privacy because no one knows where that node is, whose node that is, or anything. So when you broadcast to the network, you've increased your privacy because it's sort of a black box. It's opaque. The other thing, so that's one important thing. The other thing is it does add decentralization to the network. So if we could have a node in every home, and we all decide together, here are the rules that we're going to run. And so if someone wants to, split off and say, we're going to have Bitcoin, but it's going to have 42 million coins instead of 21 million. Well, you can say, nope, I'm going to ignore that. I'm going to keep running my code that says there's only 21 million coins, Bitcoin, that will ever exist. And so it gives you a vote to say, here's how I choose to implement Bitcoin in my life. There are a whole lot of other things. If you've heard about like the op return, all these debates going on, there are other sort of variants of what running a node can mean and what transactions you permit, in your quote unquote mempool, which is like a pool of all the transactions that are waiting to be confirmed in a block. Trying to think if there's anything I haven't touched
That's
on.
interesting. So basically what you're saying is, and this is covered in the Bitcoin standard, but basically people say, well, can't they just change Bitcoin? Can't they just change the software and make a better one? You can, but all the Bitcoin nodes that are running around the world are running on a piece of software. If somebody wants to update the software, the individual node operators can decide, I am going to make this change update or I'm not. And you have to convince more than 70%, I think, is of the network to actually before it'll become an effective change. So it's a very slow and difficult thing to change.
Yeah, you imagine like if BlackRock, Fidelity, and the US government all got together and said, hey, we're gonna change something fundamental about Bitcoin. And we've got a bunch of Bitcoin, so that's gonna be what Bitcoin is moving forward. Well, what happens is even though they could hypothetically order, a million pieces of hardware to run a million different nodes, that what they would basically be doing if everyone else disagreed with the changes they wanted to make, they'd be siphoning themselves off and making their own little network of a million nodes that it's really each entity is its own node. Like I could run 10 nodes at my house, and if they're all doing the same thing, it doesn't matter that I have 10 nodes. It's the fact that I am choosing to run this particular instance of the Bitcoin software. And so what it gives us leverage to do is for, the 20,000 or so reachable nodes out there who aren't BlackRock and the government, for us to say, you guys feel free to go do your thing. We're going to continue running this. Now, in a situation like that, does the price of Bitcoin plummet? Probably, because now there's confusion about, well, what's going to win in the future? Is it going to be the government BlackRock version, or is it going to be the cypherpunk version, or what have you? But the integrity of the Bitcoin network as we know it can remain because we all opt to reject those changes that another party is trying to make. And so this kind of goes back to my thesis. It's like people have this mindset at times who are like, well, I'm just one person. Like, what am I really going to do? It's like, yeah, but if we all believe that, then Bitcoin will eventually just die because there won't be enough nodes. I'm not immediately concerned about that in any way. We have enough nodes that it's working. Will we have enough nodes when we reach 8 million people trying to operate on a Bitcoin standard? Probably not if we have 20,000 reachable nodes that we have today. And so the more that we can push people to take self-sovereignty, increase your privacy, add to the decentralization of the network, run your own node, I think the better off we're going to be. I think running a node is incredibly important if you want to be a sovereign individual. And I'll throw this out. If you want to call yourself a Bitcoin maxi or whatever, like you need to run a node. It's just crucial.
Yeah, I think it cost me $800 or something to buy the node, and the node comes with the software on it. Is that how it works? Or
Yeah.
you down there put this up new software on?
Yeah, so there are different hardware providers, manufacturers that you can use. The one, so we used to support several, but some of them were they were more like for tinkerers, people who wanted to like build a node, like you buy the assemble the pieces and everything. The one we recommend is Start9, fully open source. We know the team there really well. Great people. It has to be fully open source, otherwise we want nothing to do with it anyway. But what you're basically buying out of the box is just it's a computer. So like you could run any sort of software on this computer. What Start9 has though is just as an example, I'm not shilling Start9 today, but they have their own operating system running on this little server, and so you can connect to the server through your computer, and they have a whole app store. All open source apps. So you could download a file manager. So you could start saving your files there instead of Google Drive. And this is their notion of sovereign computing. And this is something I think
Interesting.
other people
A
should
whole
look at.
nother rabbit hole.
Whole other rabbit hole. But one of the things you can download is Bitcoin Core or Knots, which are the two bigger implementations of the Bitcoin software. And so you can download it there. There's some other configuration ability that you have, but now you're running a node. Now, that's not very particularly useful if you're not doing anything with it, but you set it up to connect to your wallet. Now you're porting your transactions through there. It's an incredible thing. Like I feel like each day I sort of begin to appreciate more and more what it is that I'm doing when I run this little box, on
Yes.
my home network. And
This is part of the learning journey, right?
it really is. It's an amazing thing to imagine. Like I'm contributing to this vast decentralized network. Reshaping the world monetary order with this little thing. Like this is my little piece of the puzzle. And I'm opting to save in Bitcoin and spend my Bitcoin when and where I can. And like all of those things are just like little ways that I'm making the world more like I would like it to be.
So to be clear, these nodes are not mining Bitcoin. They're just, they're not mining Bitcoin. So I think the big takeaway, just for those of you like, oh, this sounds all so technical, you don't need to know any of this to get started. You can go and buy a tiny little bit of Bitcoin, you can go buy $100 and start your journey and get it into cold storage and then learn how to put it and do all this, right? But the important thing that I want people to know is that just because BlackRock might own, $20 billion worth of Bitcoin, it doesn't necessarily give them 20 billion times more power, because the network and how Bitcoin operates and how many tokens there are and the size of the blocks and all these things that drive the Bitcoin network, you get one vote for one node, right? So a lot of people don't have any vote. They just own Bitcoin, but they don't get the vote in any changes. Only the node operators have any power. And that's why it's important to run a node so that you have a vote. It's kind of democratized, and it's very it's it this is this again it's this learning. It's talked about quite a bit in a Bitcoin standard, and you start to realize this technology is just really, really extraordinary. So let's talk about two more things, and then we'll sort of try and land this plane. Let's talk about why you think it's important that we spend Bitcoin. And not just save Bitcoin. Like, let's talk about that. And then I want to talk about some of these things, like these, Bitcoin lending and also these treasury companies.
So my general pre the general premise on spending Bitcoin is I think rather simple. So first of all, to clear the air, if I've ever said or indicated in any way that simply holding Bitcoin isn't using it, that's not true. I think that holding and saving in Bitcoin is a use case. What I contend is that it is an incomplete use case, and we need to best we can build a circular economy built on Bitcoin. And the reason I think that is because we have like we have years and years and years of gold sitting in Fort Knox here in the United States, or at least we think it's in Fort Knox, right? And other countries have gold reserves around the world. And gold is a pretty sound money. Like it grows relatively slowly. It's durable, right? That it's there's no one has a monopoly on gold mining, although there are, sort of like Bitcoin mining, there are a handful of players who do tend to do most of it. Gold's a pretty good form of money. It's woefully inadequate for a digital global economy, but it's a pretty good form of money. And the forever wars have continued. Everyone's getting fat. The world continues in this downward trajectory by so many metrics. And so the point I'm making is that the fact that people are stockpiling gold, wealthy individuals, maybe even, communities, individuals are stockpiling gold. Certainly governments are stockpiling gold. It's done nothing to stop the money printer and all of its downstream consequences of a money
Interesting.
printer existing.
Interesting. Yeah.
And so the fact that Bitcoin exists as also a sound money, I don't think its existence guarantees that it couldn't also be siloed off into this digital Fort Knox that the government keeps, that big corporations keep, that even individuals
Yeah.
like us keep. And the world just gets better because Bitcoin exists. I think the world, what I always say is, if the military isn't using Bitcoin to buy fighter jets, the forever wars don't stop. If that is still being funded by the money printer, I don't understand the mechanism by which the world just magically gets better. So it's a like I'll give you an example. So like I bought I mentioned this in my speech. I buy raw goat milk from a farmer just down the road from me. And I asked her if she'd start accepting Bitcoin. And she's not like a Bitcoiner. She doesn't really know much about it, but she said, sure, because she kind of gets it. She's heard enough about it. She sort of gets it. And so now what I've done is I've opened the door for her to learn maybe a little bit more about Bitcoin. I could give her a book and she'd, maybe sit down and take a look and figure out what is this thing I'm holding exactly. And maybe someone else asks her and she's like, oh, you're the second person. Or, maybe I bump into someone picking up my milk and I tell them I'm paying with Bitcoin, you should check it out, right? Like it opens up this dialogue and this opportunity. And I'm extrapolating here, but then maybe that begins to spread. Maybe my farmer works, she goes to a rancher to buy her beef and she says, hey, can I pay you in Bitcoin? Like I've got some that this guy keeps paying me every couple of weeks for milk. Like, I don't know, what would you think? And he's like, oh, I've heard something about that. There's this Texas Slim guy here in the States who has this thing. Yeah, I'll accept Bitcoin for, a small percentage of what I'm selling. And when we begin to gradually grow this to where it becomes an unstoppable medium of exchange force that like the cat's out of the bag. It's too late for anyone to say, well, you can't use Bitcoin. It's like everyone's already using Bitcoin. Like, what do you mean you can't use Bitcoin to pay for things? Like it becomes legal tender just because we all agree it becomes legal tender. And we just kind of, give the middle finger to the government and continue on our way.
I think the small business owners, when the penny drops, that you can just walk in and show me the QR code, bang, pay it, and they see it going to their Lightning wallet, and then they go, "Well, what do I do with this now?" You say, "Well, if you want, you can send it to your exchange and sell it and get fiat money if you want. Or you can just keep this here and it'll just go up in value, whereas your fiat money is going to go down. Or you might, transfer some of it and turn it into fiat money if you need it to pay a bill. Or you could, and once they start to use it, and that was so powerful at Bitcoin Prague. When I went in there, I went to buy a hat. And the girl said, "Yeah, no problem. It's 40 euros or whatever it was, 30 euros. But we don't take cash. You have to pay Bitcoin." I'm like, "I haven't got any Bitcoin that I can give you because it's all in, multi-sig." And so she said, "No problem. Download this wallet," which I got onto my phone right away. It's here. It's called Blink. So I downloaded Blink, and then she said, "Go to those guys in the next den. They had this black box, and I fed some Czech crowns in it. Had a flashing digital sign that said Fiat Hell, and it consumed my 1,000 crowns or whatever. I was 500 crowns or whatever, and then a QR code appeared on the screen, and then I scanned it with my Blink app." And then moments later, I converted straight into Bitcoin. And then she said, "Okay, come in." Then I scanned the QR code, bought the hat, and I was buying beer and I was buying coffee. And they were going for the world record of the most number of Bitcoin transactions in one place over a weekend. And when you start to use it, and I really like that explanation. I've been thinking about doing some coaching just one-on-one with people because I get asked all the time for that. I thought I would do it just to say to people, yes, but you got to pay me in Bitcoin, just so they're forced to go buy it and then transfer it. And dealing with you guys, Tony only takes Bitcoin. And I really like that because it is in the using that it forces people to lose their fear of it. And it forces it's a vote out of the fiat system. And like when you said, if they're buying tanks and planes and stuff with Bitcoin, it's honest money. It's been earned. It hasn't just been printed. It makes them reassess. Like in the old days with wars, kings were very, very careful about going to wars because they had to get the gold, which required real energy, or had to take it from their people. It wasn't like they could just go print it. You actually had to go dig it out of the ground and exert real resource. So
Yeah.
very, I love that.
That was, and then my thought was probably incomplete on that, or at least like, why do militaries need to buy fighter jets with Bitcoin? And the reason is it's because it's a scarce form of money that you can't print more of. So for anyone listening, if you're buying with debt, you can always issue more debt, especially if you're the United States and you've got the global money printer, basically, or you just use freshly printed money to pay for the jet. There's no stopping you from buying another fighter jet and more bombs and more ammunition and increasing the salary to attract more soldiers and buying more drones. And like the list goes on and on. So the question is, how do you, like, what is the mechanism by which we can constrain these incentives? And the answer is sound money. And
Correct.
specifically, the answer is Bitcoin. It's what's the best form of sound money? Gold failed because you have to have IOUs to transact globally. Bitcoin,
Yes.
you don't need IOUs to transact globally. You can transact peer-to-peer, no intermediaries, no censorship, permissionlessly. I mean, all of the things we talk about. So,
Jack Mallers put it so well. He said, you know, I'm a young person, I'm a millennial, and all those bombs that have been flying over the borders and all these wars. Every one of those bombs, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of dollars, is just being printed. What does that mean? It means my future and my kids' future is being sold today.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like you are stealing our future economic value with every time you push that button and go and drop bombs on some foreign country and kill people. And we're paying for it. And we don't have any choice as young Americans. We are funding death. It's
Yeah.
pretty heavy. It's pretty heavy. But that's the evil of fiat currency. Whereas like gold is honest money because you have to expend real resource to get it, and you can't manufacture it. You have to get it out of the ground. Same thing with Bitcoin. This is why gold, a lot of gold bugs and Bitcoiners have so much overlap, and a lot of gold bugs just don't really understand Bitcoin just yet.
Yeah. More will get there. You know, like Jack's point is a good one. I was talking to a baby boomer friend recently, about basically, you know, Social Security here in the US is bankrupt. They can't afford it. And the only option is going to be to, you know, to print, and the tax base probably isn't going to be enough to cover the obligations that they have. And this guy said, yeah, but you know, they made these promises to, you know, the baby boomers. They can't just rug pull them and say sorry. And I said that's fine, but you realize, like, if the baby boomers don't pay for it, like the millennial or the Gen X or the millennials or, you know, Gen Z, like someone is paying the price. And you may say, well, I think that as a baby boomer, everyone else should pay the price, but like that's not very nice. And if you're Gen Z, you might say, well, I don't want to pay the price, the baby boomer should. I'm not saying who should or shouldn't. I mean, I would probably say that the baby boomers have broadly gotten us into this mess. The thing is, it wasn't each individual baby boomer. It was a bunch of idiot baby boomers and, you know, positions of power. But it's like those are messes that we can avoid if the money printer dies. If we don't defeat the money printer once and for all. And I'm not saying that if I could. You know, I have this like debate with myself. If I could wave a magic wand and make the money printer at the, you know, end the Fed tomorrow, do I do that? And the reason it's a debate in my mind is because at the end of the day, I want the Fed defeated. I have no idea what the unintended consequences of ending the Fed so drastically would be. You know, like, you know, like
Not a
because.
soft, I don't need to be a soft landing.
No, it would be far from a soft landing. And so my hope is that in the absence of the Fed being ended tomorrow, how do we like gradually enable this peaceful revolution to take over and smooth that transition out of a world of central banks into a world of decentralized money?
I think it was Henry Ford said that if people understood money, there'd be a revolution before sunrise, you know? And in Australia, we say banking and sausages. It's better
Oh yeah, absolutely.
that you
Absolutely.
don't know. Let's finish off with your thoughts around Bitcoin treasury companies. We just did a podcast on this and Bitcoin lending products. I have my views about it. But I'd be interested in your views as well. You guys, especially Tony, he's got a real hard line on this stuff. I don't know that I 100% agree with Tony, but I love Tony's passion no matter what. So what's your view?
Yeah, my view, I tend to align with Tony. My view's a little more nuanced. So let's start with treasury companies. Okay. So I think it is great that corporations want to buy Bitcoin. I think like I don't feel that way about government. I think it's cool that corporations, people, private businesses want to buy Bitcoin. I would probably take issue with the ways in which these companies are accumulating Bitcoin, and it's basically saying, "Hey, there is a second best, and it's our stock or it's our debt, and we're going to use your money to buy Bitcoin." If I were running a business like that, I think for me to feel like I'm operating in good faith, I would need to use positive cash flows, existing reserves, and payment for goods and services to build my treasury. I would end up with a lot less Bitcoin doing it that way, but I wouldn't feel like I owed someone something. Like we're just using the productive nature of the business to put whatever we can into Bitcoin. So I, what Michael Saylor is doing or anyone else, they have every, if people want to buy their debt and buy their stock and they're going to use that to buy Bitcoin, it's a private contract between individuals and those companies. They have every right to do that. I don't think I'd feel comfortable with going about it this way, even if financially it's absolutely genius. I think Michael Saylor is obviously a very bright guy. So that's sort of one thing is awesome they're buying it. I'm not a big fan of how they're doing it, but I get it. They're going to optimize their, their Bitcoin allocation, accumulation in that way. Where I then have an issue with these is again, private contract. If you want to buy MicroStrategy, if you want to buy their debt, go for it. Like you have every right to do that. I'm not saying you shouldn't be able to do that. What I'm saying is, I think that most people are don't understand what they're doing. They think that they're buying some sort of a Bitcoin play. What they're doing is they're speculating on a fiat stock or a fiat company. Simply because that company is doing what I would argue the prudent thing for that individual to be doing, and that's buying Bitcoin. You have no right to that Bitcoin because you bought their stock. Like you're not going to get Bitcoin. You could argue that, well, I'm going to outpace Bitcoin's, returns, and I'm going to use that to buy Bitcoin because like that's ultimately what I'm doing. It's like, okay, that's fine. Just make sure you understand all the counterparty risk, the capital gains taxes, all of these. You are still speculating on a fiat company, and you might win, and good for you if you do. I'm just not a speculator, but it's you're not buying Bitcoin. Like these are two completely distinct exercises. Buying MicroStrategy or any of these, treasury companies, I think you should buy, stock of a company for the, underlying business that you have faith in and you think is going to do good things, because you're not necessarily going to win just because they're buying more Bitcoin. I think probably the pool of successful Bitcoin treasury companies shrinks over time, and a few are going to outperform Bitcoin, but I'm not here for the strictly number go up. I'll take 50% CAGR or whatever it ends up being. And if you got 70% with MicroStrategy, good for you. I didn't take on a bunch of counterparty risk to do it though. Most people, I just don't think understand that distinction. So that's maybe sort of the way of my best way of framing. Not even my issue, just like my raising awareness that people understand what it is that they're getting themselves into. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I've thought about it quite deeply. I have quite a bit of MicroStrategy as well. And I think there's two things when you assess a treasury company. One is the stock price, and the other one is the Bitcoin per share. Because when you're buying a share in MicroStrategy, you own a piece of the assets of the company. And I'm not.
Is there a way for you to withdraw the Bitcoin in some way from that?
No. I mean, you're in a fiat world, so you'd have to sell your share of the company and convert it back to Bitcoin. So I look at like the Bitcoin per share. So if I own part of MicroStrategy, I look at as a shareholder, what I'm interested in is how much, if all the Bitcoin in that pool is divided amongst the shareholders when it's all said and done, are they getting me more Bitcoin per share, regardless of the share price? Is there more Bitcoin per share that I own if I go with MicroStrategy? And the answer to date has been they are doing it in a creative manner. So for every time they issue a bond or issue debt or whatever, and they're doing less debt now, much more convertible notes and different things like that. Are they doing it in a manner where, as a shareholder, I'm getting more Bitcoin per share if they liquidated all the stock and they took the cash in and then handed it out to the shareholders on a per share basis? Am I going to be net better off? And the
And
answer
Adam,
is yes.
yeah, and Adam, I think that's like I think that's a perfectly fine position to take, as long as you understand that Michael Saylor could get hit by a bus tomorrow and the whole strategy falls apart. That Coinbase holds the majority of their coins; they're not showing proof of reserves, and Coinbase could be co-opted by
Oh,
government.
totally. Yeah, I absolutely agree with
And
all of that.
Coinbase could be hacked, and Coinbase could tell them, "Hey, sorry, we've got a withdrawal period on like." As long as people understand that they are playing a fiat game in the hopes of accumulating more Bitcoin down the road, assuming that this speculative bet pays off, and they understand those myriad risks, great. Like I'm not going to stop anyone from doing this. I think you seem to have a grasp of what those risks are. I
Oh,
think
totally.
too many people are coming into Bitcoin today, and they think that the way you get into Bitcoin is buying MicroStrategy. It's like build your own private reserve first. And like if you don't want to, then don't. But like I'm not telling you what you have to do. I'm telling you what I think people should do. Build your own private reserve. If you have some money you want to speculate with, you think you can outperform Bitcoin with MicroStrategy, great. If you've got a retirement account and you want to dump it into the ETFs or MicroStrategy, great. Like I get it. I understand that there are
That's
certain
exactly what I did. And I had a fairly decent Bitcoin stack beforehand. So I agree with like they're two very different investments. And my thinking is Bitcoin is such a powerful asset to buy just on its own without any counterparty risk. You're not reliant on the stock market and you don't have to understand convertible notes and bond issuances and liquidation rates and all of that stuff. Like this is where, all these, I think what you said about there'll be a few that'll survive, but many will not use the tools that are available to them as acutely and skillfully as the team at MicroStrategy have, right? Like Saylor's been a visionary, and a lot of these Me Too companies may not have their visionary or team that can accrete value in the same way. So I think in short, no, you're absolutely right. There's so many variables and so many risks with any of these things,
And I think maybe the other sort of complaint I alluded to is that I think there are, I think what Michael Saylor is doing, as I said, is it's just financial genius. I really tire of all the hype around Saylor and Strategy and 21 and, Nakamoto and like all these, like, I think what like if you all want to if people want to do that if they want to buy Bitcoin like and people want to speculate then great. I think it's a disservice to people who are getting in and figuring this stuff out. And I felt this way. I was walking around the sort of a side note, but I felt like when I was walking around the conference in Las Vegas a few weeks a month and a half ago, the number of just like garbage sort of products. It's like it's a free market. They have a right to exist, but to represent them at a supposedly a Bitcoin conference is it's easy for me to just walk by them and roll my eyes. But if someone's there like excited, they've been in Bitcoin 6 months, they paid, to come to this thing and they're like, okay, what do you do? And they're like, oh, you can stake your Bitcoin and earn shit coins back. They might be like, oh, I guess this is what Bitcoiners do. Like I didn't know. Okay. Like tell me more. And like and the same thing is true though with MicroStrategy. Or with any of these. If this was just like a, hey, good job, Michael Saylor. Let's applaud him for like having the balls to do this and to buy Bitcoin and to give people a speculative strategy if they so desire, great. But like the fact that He is the one getting 1,000 pictures taken with him. And Tony, who's like, hey, let's stick to the ethos of Bitcoin, self-sovereignty. Don't lose your stack. Like, you can secure this in your, and like, Tony can walk through the halls at BTC Prague and, get one or two pictures here or there. Like, to me, that's a travesty. Like, Tony is doing more for the ethos of Bitcoin than Michael Saylor has ever done. And it's not because Michael Saylor, I learned a lot from Michael Saylor early on in my journey. But there are a lot of people coming in the last 18 months who heard very, who've heard very different things from Michael Saylor than I did in my first year of listening to him. It's digital capital. There is a second best. Leverage up and buy Bitcoin, right? Like all these things. It's like, okay, like, yeah, if you got the dough to do that, like, knock yourself out. I think you should probably just buy some Bitcoin, take it into self-custody, and like, stay humble.
I think if you really understand just the Bitcoin way, sorry, the Bitcoin standard, and you understand that the world's money is broken, and your base thesis is people are going to want a better technology. Like, I met Elon Musk in 2012, and I saw the first Teslas, right? And I didn't buy a Tesla. And the minute I got in a Tesla, the very first the Teslas that came out, the S's, whatever, not the Roadster. He turned up at the meeting in a Roadster, that like one of the very, very, very early Roadsters. The first production car I got in very early, and I didn't buy Tesla stock. And then I experienced Amazon very early, and I didn't buy Amazon stock. And that was two of the dumbest moves in my life, right? But when you look at Bitcoin, when you really understand it, to not buy into the network, it would be a huge mistake. And I think if your base case is there's $800-900 trillion worth of assets in the world, Bitcoin's the best performing of all of the asset classes, yet it still only represents 2 trillion of the 900 trillion. Like, just that alone says to me it's going to grow really strongly. And if the CAGR is 40% a year, that's extraordinary. Just start there. Learn to buy it, learn to secure it. And pretty quickly, if you get a compound interest calculator app out and you start to simplify your life, stack sats, and just watch what happens, the power of compound interest, and don't give it 5 years. Look out, if you're a young person, look out 20 years. I know it seems like a long time, but if you can invest $1,000 a month into Bitcoin for 20 years, it is frightening how rich you'll get just by doing that without complicating or learning. But humans have this tendency to want to create complexity in their lives, right? And it's taken me a long time. I just sold all my real estate. I've just and everything I look at right now is I just sold my last business, my e-commerce business. And somebody said, why did you do that? And I said, because, dude, I now for the first time understand counterparty risk. As an e-commerce seller, I've got US dollar exchange rates. I've got containers that fall off ships between America, where I buy my inventory and bring it to Australia. I've got insurance. I've got ads, Google PPC. Google changes their algorithm. Facebook changes their policies. A new competitor comes in. A new technology comes along. Like, I was selling electric toilets and a patented electric toilet, and it's a good business. It's got recurring revenue, all these things. But there's all these risks on every single side. And then I look at Bitcoin and I'm like, Bitcoin grows at 50% a year. Like, that's the hurdle rate. Like, can I get better than 50% a year in business? And what is the complexity of running that business? And it's not even close, right? Like, why am I doing anything but just buying Bitcoin and waiting? And that's so hard for people to unwind in their head.
I think that's really it, is we're accustomed to life
In
being,
hard mode.
it has to be complicated, right? Like, it can't just be simple. And so again, while it sounds like you've got a solid handle on the risk you're taking on with MicroStrategy,
Oh,
and
totally. Yeah.
I think probably most people just don't. So again, my intention here is not to disparage Saylor. Would I do things differently if I were in his shoes, just for my peace of mind? Yes. Does that mean he's a bad guy? No. Does he say things that I think are very unhelpful to people who are trying to figure out Bitcoin now in a way that he didn't, I don't know, 18, 24 months ago? Yeah, I mean, that's just my honest assessment. And some of his comments, like his proof of reserves, like I can't show that, because it'd be like you're giving up your family's address or something. I mean, We know Satoshi's, we know his addresses, and no one's gotten a hold of those coins. I understand he operates in a very different environment than I do. Highly regulated, lots of eyes on him. I mean, he's a billionaire. Like, he's got all of these considerations. I do sympathize, and it's easy for me to sit here behind a microphone and a camera and say, well, if I were, I would do X, Y, and
It's
Z.
hard to know, right? Yeah, it's
But
hard.
to some degree, I guess a perspective from just behind a camera and a microphone allows me the ability to say, here's what I think would be optimal. And it's not what I'm seeing. And so if there were a way to inch closer to that, I think it would be beneficial for a lot of people trying to figure this out right now.
Yeah, last one is just Bitcoin lending, and I guess, Bitcoin lending, for guys who don't know what that is, basically means you get your Bitcoin, you put it in somebody else's custody, and they lend you money against it. And if you don't pay it back, they take the Bitcoin. Or if the Bitcoin price drops too much, you get a margin call, and they say, you've either got to give us some more money or some more Bitcoin, or we're going to sell your Bitcoin. And then you end up losing your Bitcoin as a result of it. I mean, it's obviously got risks with it. Is that anything you want to add to that?
I'll give you my thoughts, and I'd like to, if you got a few minutes, I'd like to hear your thoughts as well. See if we part ways on this one as well. So Bitcoin lending, I think there are a few concerns I have with it. So first of all, most of the people, like I look at like Jack Mahler's, right? It's a strikes offer in this. I think Jack Mahler seems like an awesome guy. I have learned a lot. He seems like a real Bitcoiner. So anything I say, again, no, not intended to disparage Jack. I'd love to sit down and have a beer with that guy. Okay, so my concern with it is, if you look at it, I'll use his product's example, or his product as an example, just because there are a number of other solutions out there. So my understanding of it, based on seeing him speak in Vegas, is that you give us your Bitcoin. We don't ask for a credit score, we don't check to see your income. Like, we've got your Bitcoin. That's the collateral. And we give you $50,000, $100,000, and you pay us back at 9, 10, 12% interest. And what it allows you to do is, I want to build a house, but I've got this giant Bitcoin stack, and I'm going to use that as collateral because I don't have a whole lot of fiat or whatever. Or I want to put in a swimming pool or whatever, buy a car. And so it gives you fiat liquidity, and the ability to leverage the Bitcoin that you have to accumulate that. I think that there are some people, a small handful of people generally, who have both the Bitcoin stack and the security of cash flow and the risk management analysis capabilities to do that well. To take out fiat, put their Bitcoin up as collateral. Like, for example, if you have 100 Bitcoin, I wish. If you have 100 Bitcoin and you've worked at, in Big Four consulting for 30 years, and that you're going to make $350,000, $500,000, $600,000 a year, and you're in a hot industry, consulting in a hot industry, very low risk, you're going to lose your job. Yeah, I mean, post a few Bitcoin, you've got secure cash flow to cover that, and great, you can now buy a bigger house, or buy that Ferrari that you've always wanted, or what have you. I think those people probably aren't going to get wrecked unless, of course, Strike in some way gets wrecked, or overplays their hand, or does rehypothecate. I think Jack's come out very clearly and said that they're not, but there are going to be options who do rehypothecate funds. I think for 99% of people, they've got a small stack and they can't afford something that they really want, and they don't know how to analyze. They're a young person who has a job that, it's a an early career sales role that they get fired from, or there could be a downturn in the economy, or any number of things could happen. They lose that cash flow, but they still have this loan that they have to pay back. And they also don't know how to assess the risk of, I'm keeping that my Bitcoin now with a third party. I have counterparty risk. How could the government mess this up? How could regulations mess this up? How could any number of things mess this up for me? And I think a lot of people are going to get wrecked because the viability of their ability to pay back that loan wasn't analyzed by someone else. Not that that's a justification. You need to be able to analyze that risk yourself. So I think a lot of people with smaller stacks, less secure income, and poor risk management capabilities, are going to ultimately pay a price trying to play a fiat game. As Tony says, if you can't afford it, that sucks, but maybe it's just not time for you to afford it. I think that's for a lot of people. So that's sort of one sort of practical, I guess, perspective. My philosophical take too, as someone who thinks that spending Bitcoin is very important, is not that spending fiat is evil, because we all have to do it to some degree in our daily lives, even those of us trying our best to operate on a Bitcoin standard. I do, it does cause me a bit of concern that it might lull us into a place of complacency where we're like, oh, I can always get more fiat for my Bitcoin, and so I never need to spend my Bitcoin. Like, that's kind of the idea, right? Like, I never need to spend my Bitcoin. And philosophically, if my goal is my son doesn't turn, 18 and get shipped off to some stupid war in the Middle East, well, I need us to be spending Bitcoin now in order to achieve that future. And I need military jets being purchased by militaries with Bitcoin. Do we sort of end up in this place where we're like, oh no, we just kind of exchange, it's just this commodity now. Like, I talked about in my speech. It's I post my Bitcoin as collateral, it's this commodity. I get my fiat and then I go spend that into the world. And then Bitcoin as a medium of exchange never really catches, because everyone's just playing this sort of continuous loop of Bitcoin-backed loans, if that makes some sense. What do you think? Give me your word.
It's one of those things that sort of brings up conflicting arguments in me that I probably haven't fully resolved. I like what Jeff Booth says about Bitcoin being a protocol. And for people who think that they're late to this, he says, it took us 16 years, I think he said, before the internet settled on www. HTTP colon forward slash, right? That took 16 years. There was all these fights, protocol wars, before that became the standard. And then once that was established as the standard, all these layer one and twos and so on happened, and we experienced the internet how we experience today. We had browsers, then after browsers, we had websites, then we had services and SaaS and all this stuff that grew on top of the base layer. And he sort of said, Bitcoin has won the protocol wars, and businesses, it's winners most take most, and protocols, it's winners take all. And so, if I think about Bitcoin now, and I start to think about Bitcoin lending, to me, it's one of the a sign of maturity that it's now being it's in the U.S. just this week, I think it was that Trump.
The FHFA or the FHSA, the yeah they they are they want lenders to account for Bitcoin as a part of your net worth.
Recognizing it on your serviceability, like if you have Bitcoin, then that should be assessed as an asset for lending, which is a big thing. So I actually went through the process with Ledin just to see. I didn't do it, but I went through, just I actually wanted to experience it, and I was like, oh my God, this is the future of money, because it literally, I had to KYC, basic KYC. But I didn't have to hand in a bank statement, a letter from an employer, nothing. It was literally 5 minutes. Who am I? Prove who I am. And then, okay, how much do you want? Okay, 50 grand you need to put, 100,000 of Bitcoin collateral. So double the amount I wanted to borrow. And then wire it to that address and we'll put the money in your bank in 10 minutes. And I'm like, oh my God, like this is how money should be, right? Like, instead of the bullshit that the banks put you through and like want a blood example and assigned, you know what I mean? Like it's broken, like that, whereas this was like, oh, it clicked. I've heard so many guests say to me on the pod that I've interviewed, when the financial system, when TradFi figures out that Bitcoin is the most pristine collateral, I've heard this term pristine collateral over and over and over. It wasn't until I went through that it clicked. Of course, it's the most cleanest thing, because if I default, or if I don't do what I say I'm going to do, if I haven't thought through the risks, well, the bank is going to liquidate me and they're going to sell the Bitcoin instantly, take their bit. And it creates this instant honest, and it forces, in some ways, you as a Bitcoiner to understand what you own, right? And the risks of owning it. But it kind of, so I loved all that. I was like, Bitcoin is actually making finance better. It is fixing money in a different way, right? And I love the idea that I can keep the valuable asset and borrow the depreciating asset to buy things that I might still need, like a place to live if I wanted to buy. Like where I rent, I pay a lot of rent where I am, but maybe I buy a place, and I've got a bit of Bitcoin. And I went out and started looking for outside of Lenin. I approached some Swiss banks, and within a week, I had two term sheets, one at 2.2% interest, fully secured only by Bitcoin, and one at 4.5%. So I get to keep my Bitcoin, get the fiat, buy the property, I get the capital growth of the property, and I still keep the capital growth of the Bitcoin, and I just have to service the. And again, it comes down to I'm a sophisticated investor. I understand the risks, and I've got a decent stack to be able to do that. So I think it's an interesting evolution. And I do think it's a bit of a coming of age of Bitcoin becoming a mainstream asset. And those who saw it earlier are in a very powerful position because they have this asset that is, it's another thing is, but it's CAGRing at 40, 50% a year. Your borrowing capacity is growing at 40, 50% a year, regardless of what you do for a job. Doesn't care what you do for a job. If the asset's going up at 40, 50% a year, you can now borrow 40 to 50% more every single year. That opens up a whole range of liberation and freedom and democratizes the game that the rich have been playing forever. Like Elon and Jeff Bezos and stuff, they don't pay tax because they just live on borrowing against their assets. Well, that's been out of touch for most people because they don't start companies with equity like that. But the average Joe can have a $100,000 Bitcoin stack and it growing like that. It gives them access to cash to live. And I don't know, it's kind of raising a whole bunch of mixed things for me. And I do love the fact that there are serious people like Jack Mullers is now in a position of real power. He's partnered with, Howard Lutnick and SoftBank with 43,000 Bitcoin in his base. You've got young, true Bitcoiners, true humanitarians who are becoming the face of the next generation of TradFi, which is going to be Bitcoin-fi. And that gives me so much hope and excitement to think that someone like Jack Mullers can mortgage my house for me because I trust Jack, right? I don't
Yeah,
know.
I mean, I just maybe I'm just like I would be surprised if Jack is trying to rug pull anyone. I think that's,
100%.
but
That
that,
man
but
is a good human.
I think he is. But that's a very different thing than me sending my Bitcoin to him and taking out a loan for something that I otherwise couldn't afford. And so, I think there's,
Well, you could afford. Maybe if you could afford it, like.
perhaps I think the and just keep in mind, I know you know this, but the other consideration is maybe you get a 40 to 50% CAGR annually over time, but we also have 80% drawdowns. And so if you haven't accounted for that, if you haven't accounted for World War III, or you haven't accounted for
Totally.
BlackRock, Coinbase having a hack and losing all their Bitcoin and an 80% drawdown, and then you get liquidated because of a margin call. Like, you just have to remember, like, all of these variables are at play with something like this. I think that my hope is that at some point these products are just obsoleted. And again, it's the free market's going to do whatever it wants. What the hell I want is of very little importance to the free market. My hope is that there is no other currency someday, and I know it's not tomorrow or next week or even next year, but someday there isn't some other currency that you're taking out you're posting your Bitcoin as collateral in order to get more of. Like why would anyone accept dollars, right? Like, the world's just accepting Bitcoin. Like, that's the future I want. So, like, I my hope is that 20 years from now, Strike's lending product is completely gone. I understand why people might want it in this day and age, but ultimately, I sure hope that's not the future that we're in for. Like, why would we need dollars when we have Bitcoin globally adopted, available, easy to use as a medium of exchange, new technologies even beyond anything we know today for self-custody, for Lightning, day-to-day transactions, those sorts of things. So I think there's this part of me that understands the practical reality, but I fear for people who don't fully analyze the risk. And then there's like the I just going back and forth between this practical side of me and this philosophical side. Philosophically, I hope the world that we someday inhabit has better Bitcoin-oriented solutions than a Bitcoin for fiat product, I guess is maybe
We're
kind of.
going through, I think we're going through that transition of like the two sort of intersecting and blending, and some stuff will probably come out the other side if we do end up in a Bitcoin dominant world, I think some of that stuff will come through, and a lot of it will die and turn out to be bad experiments.
Yeah. I think a lot of things will ch I think a lot of things if we could just teleport ourselves to a world on a Bitcoin standard, I think a lot of things change. I think debt, banking, a lot of those things change. People, say, "Hey, I'll give you Bitcoin to start this business. I get equity." And I know that happens in the fiat world, but a lot of times it's people taking out loans and taking on debt. And so I think this just like the structure of how a lot of things work probably fundamentally differ. Probably, hopefully, a lot of it goes away because it only made sense on a debt-based, in a debt-based fiat system. But time will tell. We're just going to have to wait it out and see with some of these things.
I think the message for everyone listening today is, if you don't own Bitcoin yet, just buy some and learn how to custody it. That's step one. And the Bitcoin Way, there'll be a link under this video because we're an official partner of the Bitcoin Way. Click on that link. You can have a 30-minute chat with these guys one-on-one for free. It's about a $5,000 investment for the basic level of education to have them working with you as a consultant, and you can call them up and have one-on-ones and the whole lot. And then it goes up a little bit more if you want to learn about cybersecurity and all the other stuff that they do. But the way to look at that, guys, is it's a $5,000 investment into learning perhaps one of the most valuable things there is in life, which is how to store your own time and energy in a non-leaking asset, which is Bitcoin, and to do it in such a way that you are not at any counterparty risk. And if the government changes the rules, and you have the power to just say, okay, well, I'm going to go, and you just leave, and you take with you your economic power, and it can't be stopped at any on or off ramp, like a bank or a stock exchange, or your money's in a digital token the government's issued. It's you've got self-sovereignty. You are in control. Like the same way a farmer grows his own food, doesn't matter what happens at Woolworths, he's growing his own food.
Yeah, absolutely.
But in a place that the government can't touch, which is cyberspace. Even the farmer could have his land taken from him because it's owned by the state, right? So when push comes to shove, you find that out pretty quickly when they turn up with guns. So it's really the only thing that as long as you can move, get on a plane, you are free, which is a pretty cool feeling. Michael, is there anything else you want to finish with, mate?
No, I mean, just one comment. So we do have some lower cost options for getting started with self-custody, just for people who might be scared off by the $5,000 price tag. So we've got I won't go into all the details, but you can get started in self-custody for less than that. We have a number of
How much is it? I just want to make sure people calling you are calling you knowing, you know what I mean? Like, I don't want people ringing up thinking it's $100.
Yeah, so anywhere in the $1,500 to $5,500 range would be typical. But it's what the difference is the inclusion of things like running a node. We help people with inheritance planning, doing disaster recovery scenarios if your hardware wallet breaks, those sorts of things. And so I just encourage anyone to schedule a call with the team because it's free. Figure out like where on that spectrum you might fall, what you can do. But I fully agree with you. Get off zero and then figure out how to take self-custody as quickly as possible. And then if you want to take on more counterparty risk and have some of your stack somewhere else, or you want to speculate in MicroStrategy or whatever, I think go for it if you understand the risks you're taking. But I think everyone needs a self-sovereign stack of Bitcoin and 100% self-custody. That's just me,
There's
non-negotiable. But yeah, you can. So yeah, go to the bitcoinway.com. I think it's slash unemployable is the
slash
URL.
unemployable. Yeah.
And you can follow us on X. We're at the Bitcoin Way underscore. I'm there as well at the other M Jordan. I'm the less famous Michael Jordan, but hopefully I have the most Bitcoin of any Michael Jordan. No, man, but hey, I can't thank you. It was a pleasure meeting you. I appreciate the kind words about the speech and for having me on. This is a blast.
Dude, I absolutely loved it. I appreciate you, man. Thank you for doing your bit in your corner of the world. I'll keep doing my bit in my corner of the world, and hopefully we can help some people to just get free and protect your family's future. So, with that said, man, thanks so much, and I'm sure we'll have you back on at some point in the future.
Amen. Thank you, Adam. Cheers.
Hey there, I hope you enjoyed that episode of Unemployable. If you'd like to watch another episode, just click there.